Hello, everyone. Welcome to CTF Radio. We have a very fun episode for you today. I'm joined, as always, by Jan.
Hello, hackers.
So now it's our like third or fourth episode with the intro, and I'm kind of regretting letting you make me do it live. So we just like bob our heads to it.
We gotta have a dance party episode. That would be awesome. Extended.
I don't know any TikTok dances, but are you willing to teach me?
I am willing to teach you.
Wow. All right.
I don't know them either, but I will learn them.
It's great. Okay, you're going to go to it. Do they have like dance studios that will teach you like ballroom dancing and TikTok dances?
Yeah, man. Money can be exchanged for a wide range of goods and services.
Not picking on that thread at all, just moving right on past it. So that's great. So we have a guest with us today who I believe on our last episode was probably the most cited person on that entire episode. I believe his name has come up several times in our past episodes, but we haven't had a chance to chat with him. So do you have anything else you want to say about to hype up our guest?
Yeah, I want to say one of the coolest things about this podcast is being able to kind of chat with absolute CTF legends like ourselves, but better. And you know, back in the day, I used to quote Steve Jobs a lot. And one of the many,
you
many,
say
many,
you,
many,
you mean me? Me, you? Yeah. Okay, cool.
You. No, the one quote, okay. The one quote is like, A's hire A's and B's hire C's. And you had just hired me, and so that was very, very good all around. But I think it also goes for kind of chatting with people, right? For seeking out advice, for any sort of interactions. It's very cool to be able to have people on this show, and it's like, holy shit, we have this person. And this is one of these moments, right? So to put Robert on the spot immediately, it's awesome. Every time, you know, I see this guy at a CTF, or I see some blog or some, Discord message, I'm like, yeah, this guy is a badass lead hacker. So awesome to have you on here, Robert.
Hey, nice to be here. Finally, yeah, it's a chance to actually talk to you guys in CTF Radio.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Why don't you, can you give us your like brief overview of like all of the hats and stuff that you wear in your job and in your CTF life?
Yeah. So professionally, I am a associate professor now.
Hey, congratulations.
Welcome to the club.
Of computer science. At the University of British Columbia here in Vancouver, BC. So my kind of day job is doing research in computer science, but specifically in human-computer interaction, so augmented and virtual reality. So that VR, not the other VR, interesting enough.
Yeah.
So that's a lot of what I do in kind of my day job. I teach grad course on signal processing machine learning. I, you know, mentor a bunch of PhD and master students in computer science and human-computer interaction.
That's great. So we'll just the audience, we'll put a little pin in this, because this is part of the reason why we're so excited to talk to Robert, is because his, as you can see, his research background is not like Jan and I in cybersecurity and doing security stuff all day. It's something very, very different. So I think we'll get into that later. But so what's your, the CTF side of you?
Yeah. So the CTF side is that I've been with PBP for now 10 plus years. I've kind of lost count. It's been quite a long time. I joined PBP while I was doing my PhD in computer science at Carnegie Mellon University. I was doing my PhD in HCI at the time. So I somehow managed to stumble upon PvP, the CTF thing, you know, that whole bit. Joined PvP, and then I've been playing with them for basically the last 10 years. After I graduated out of CMU, went to UBC, UBC didn't have a CTF team of any kind. And so I said, well, I have to start one. So I did that. I'm basically the faculty mentor and lead for, I wouldn't say I'm the leader really, because the students do all that. I'm just the faculty mentor who kind of just makes things run in the background, I guess, for the Maple Bacon CTF team. Very cool. Most recently, you know, Maple Bacon, The Duck, and PvP all joined forces. We were MMM at DEF CON, which I've now gone to a lot of times as well. So that's sort of the CTF side. Yeah.
Wow. Wild. Okay. So then let's dig in. You kind of, you know, so you're doing, okay. So take us back before, so you're doing HDI research at CMU. So what were you doing before that? Where'd you do your undergrad? Like, were you, is anything in your background security related?
No, not really. yeah, no. So my undergrad was at the University of Waterloo. I did what ultimately ended up being a double degree, or not double degree, sorry, double major in combinatorics optimization and computer science. That's a huge mouthful, I know. But basically,
I'm sorry, what?
Combinatorics optimization, computer science.
Okay, so those two are one degree, and then
combinatorics and optimization is
one degree,
is one like major, and then the other major is computer science. It's Waterloo. It's a Bachelor of Mathematics. But
interesting.
Yeah. At one point, actually, I thought I was going to go into pure math, but that turned out to be too abstract for me. So combinatorics was a bit more grounded, I think, for me, you know, a bit more kind of easy for me to understand, I suppose. But at Waterloo, I wasn't really doing any security stuff. I think I took one security class, maybe, and it was like, okay, I guess that's security. Had I had done actually several research internships while I was while I was in Waterloo. I did my research internships at the University of Saskatchewan in HCI, so I had basically interned at the HCI lab there, and that's actually the main reason why I ended up in HCI at all, is because I had done these research internships as an undergrad, and so by the time I applied for PhDs, I actually applied for the computer science program at CMU, not for the HCI program, but they looked at my publication record, which was just a couple of, you know, undergrad publications, right? And they're like, well, those are all HCI publications, so you should go to apply to our HCI program. And that was it. So I kind of got maybe shoehorned a little bit in that direction, but it was fun. I mean, I met, you know, some really, really good folks there. But yeah, my background really doesn't have any actual security in it at all.
Wow. And then this is, I mean, this is also, go ahead, please, Jan.
Sorry. So that means, based on our previous episode, you must have gotten into Capture the Flag through the Super Smash Brothers pipeline.
Fortunately, I am really bad at video games. Being really bad at video games is actually the security connection. Because basically, I was much more interested in how the video games worked and how to mess with them than to actually play the games properly. Because I have terrible reaction times, terrible hand-eye coordination, and all that. And I can't really like play games all that well, so I might as well just go figure out, like, say, how to mess with their save files, which I was doing as a kid. So, you know,
okay, there we go. So you do have some, like, you know, game hacking, I mean, as a whole.
Yeah, basically, right? Although it was mostly, like, honestly, most of the game hacking I did was local single player, like, mm-hmm. save file stuff. I'm sort of a file format nerd, I guess, so I kind of like how, like, you know, how data gets saved, how it gets, you know, like, because a lot of the games will use like obfuscation and stuff on mm-hmm. their save files. So that's kind of fun to take apart and figure out how that works. And then, like, you know, tweak all the numbers to their maximum, whatever. And, you know, yeah, that's sort of like, that was fun for me. That was much more fun than playing the games, honestly.
So wait, okay, this is, yeah, were you following guides? Were you trying to do this like by hand? Were you reversing the games are just reversing the file formats?
Very early on, it was really just like, do something, save the file, see how the bytes change. Because they'd use like XOR encryption or whatever, right? So like, be really trivial. This is way, way, way back when I was in, you know, high school. Right?
Yeah, wait, so what games are we talking about?
To give random stuff. I think folks. I played a fair bit of like Warcraft 3 back in the day, custom maps, and they'd have like, some of these maps would have like save functions for like RPG stuff, whatever. And I just go in and like, oh, I like, I don't want to actually like spend the time grinding to like level whatever. I'm just going to find a, you know, build myself a little save file that's like, you know, whatever. Yeah, stuff like that. I mean, there was just a, I don't even think I remember the things I was playing back in undergrad or undergrad.
Did you mess with any of the like Lua scripting of the custom apps themselves?
So Warcraft 3, yeah, was using the, like the Blizzard Jazz stuff. And I definitely was playing around with that a fair bit when I was in high school. So, you know, using like the MBQ editors and stuff like that to like take apart maps, like understanding how like they could delete the file list. And so then you had to like recover that from like the hashes and stuff like that. Like that was all kind of fun for me. But like it was much more enjoyable for me to go and figure out how a map worked and like how the coding of it worked than to, again, like play the actual thing. There was a whole series of maps that like the developers would put in like cheat codes and stuff. And what I would do is before the match would start, I'd enter the lobby, download this like brand new map I hadn't played before, open it up in the background while waiting for the game to start, find the cheat codes and then type them in. And that was like, ah, and then I would just leave because, you know, it was more fun to figure out how to cheat than to actually cheat, because I was like, okay, I'm not going to actually join the game to play this anymore. That was kind of the thing. I was a little bit naughty, I guess, but that was, yeah.
In Warcraft 3 specifically, I can really relate to this because the beta came out when I was in high school. I didn't get onto the beta because, I don't know, they had new whatever. But I joined the unofficial beta effort on the internet. I don't even remember. It was all like this BNet D, you know, running your own Battle.net, blah, blah, blah,
yeah.
blah, blah.
Yeah, okay.
And then once I got into the game, I was like, actually, I don't really want to play.
Yeah, that's like, and I wonder if there's something, we should make a list of things. If you find your child doing this thing, then you should really put them to do this. Because like me, it was, I realized playing like Diablo 2 and those kind of things, what I actually really love doing was botting, like setting up the automation stuff and like just seeing what happened. I would use auto it to try to like, and I set auto it scripts. I was playing this stupid like tank game, and I realized that you would still get some XP even if you just both like lost immediately. And so I'd set these bots to just two machines in my house play each other, and they would just all just fall off the cliff. And I did that for like a week, and I was like, wait, what am I doing? Like, I don't even care about the XP that I'm getting from doing this. I just had so much fun actually doing that. It's like, somebody should have been like, tap me on the shoulder and be like, hey, you should be a programmer. Like, you should look at code, because this is what you're doing is code, and that's what you like. And for you to be like, hey, you're staring at file formats all day. That's reverse engineering, my friend. You should just go right over here.
Yeah. 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 Honestly, so that's really where I think a lot of that interest started. But I admittedly, honestly, did not spend all that much time in undergrad nurturing that. Like Waterloo didn't really have much of a security thing going on.
Have connected it to security? Like,
I guess, I mean, you could call it hacking. And if you kind of spend enough time on the internet, people are like, oh, you're hacking. Well, yeah. I mean, I guess. I typed in a cheat code.
Right.
Like, okay, I guess that's hacking, right? I wasn't really out to cause anyone trouble. Like, I didn't want to like actually grief anyone. I'm like, okay, if you're not having fun, I don't really care. I'm just gonna leave, right? Because the fun for me was, again, kind of just figuring out like these kind of Easter eggs and stuff like that. I don't think I really understood security as like a whole topic that had connected to the game hacking stuff until much, much, much later. I took this undergrad course at Waterloo on security, and I thought it was interesting, but it wasn't like kind of like, oh, this is what I want to do kind of thing. Like that didn't really spark the whole like, oh yeah, this is definitely like my career. Maybe if it had, I would have just decided to go research in security instead. But as it was, since I had HSA publications and not security publications, it was sort of like, okay, that's your grad studies have been preordained for you, right? Mind you.
Why do you think that it didn't click, the course?
Part of it probably was that it was kind of like a normal course. It was like, okay, we're going to teach you a bunch of stuff. Like, okay, we're going to talk about like HTTP proxies, and we're going to get you to like write some code. And I was like, okay, that's neat. I had more fun. They had a user mode Linux thing that they were using to run all their stuff. I had more fun breaking that and causing it to like if you segfault user mode Linux, that's like basically kernel panicking, because it's this sort of weird like exec. I was like, that was really interesting for me, is to figure out how this little sandbox worked. And again, not really paying much attention to the content of the course. I guess that's a bad pattern with me. Although, again, I still didn't quite figure out that was security related, which is ironic in a security course. And I was like, well, this is an interesting thing that they've built, like the sandbox thing. And I'm having more fun with the sandbox than with the assignment that I'm supposed to be doing. But yeah, I mean, I guess it was just, it was more of a kind of standard course. I actually had more fun in the cryptography course. So there was an applied cryptography course that I took. And then the problem is I took a quantum course after that and got completely lost and was like, I guess that's cryptography. Right.
Yeah.
So maybe it was sort of just like kind of bad luck. Actually, in fact, I really love cryptography. It's one of the places where I get to like apply a bunch of the math stuff that I learned, right? Like all this group theory and like, you know, finite fields and stuff like that. But that's like later. I kind of rediscovered cryptography through CTF, basically.
But was the quantum course not like applied enough, or just too much quantum, not enough?
It was entirely theoretical. I mean, we're not going to like play with ions or whatever, right?
Well,
like,
sure.
Yeah. But it's all like basically, here's some linear algebra stuff. And by the way, this makes this work. And you're like, what? And it wasn't really obvious to me that this was something that was physically realizable in any sort of meaningful sense. Because they do like kind of like one lecture where they're like, by the way, you can run some experiments and this actually works. And you're like, that doesn't make any sense. And of course, it doesn't make any sense because it's quantum, right? And then later on, they start doing like Shor's algorithm, and they're like, okay, you can do like Fourier transforms. And we're like, we haven't really done normal Fourier transforms, so a quantum Fourier transform makes no sense. So there's like a bunch of stuff. Like, I did fine in the course, but it was very mechanical. It was very just like, okay, you just like apply these matrices and like things work. And you're like, okay. And then like you can factor numbers. I'm like, that's really neat. And I still don't know how that works to this very day. Something about like amplifying some vector until it like becomes obvious, but I don't, you know, stuff like that. It's like, it was a connection to like the actual, like kind of like, oh, you could break RSA with this, but we didn't really talk about that. Anyway, I guess it was just sort of the thing where like, you know, I didn't get sufficiently excited in it, because I think part of it is that a lot of that stuff was very theoretical. Like what I really love about CTS, which I guess we'll get into in a bit, is that you do the thing, you implement the thing, you break the thing, right? That's what for me was really the proof in the pudding. Like what I was doing all along was doing the thing. And once you did the thing, it was like, okay, great, I can do the thing, right? You know, but until then, it's all just theory. And I think that that's sort of what drew me and ultimately into CTS in the end.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, it could be for me once, you know, taking physics in undergrad, and once, you know, loved physics in high school, took it in undergrad, loved it. That got to the point where we hit quantum and I was like, I'm sorry, what? Like, you people don't know what's going on? Like, what the fuck? We're talking about probabilities and stuff now? Like, for me, it just lost all like intuition that I could like actually understand what was going, like, you know, develop a model of what's going on. And I just never, you know, I think I was like, okay, cool. Yeah, I'm done with physics now. I don't want any more. Thank you. Yeah, that's super interesting. I mean, I wonder, like, is there? So okay, so then you're taking some of these classes, and then how do you get hooked up into PPP while you're at CMU?
Okay, so that, like, I generally do not remember. I was always a little bit interested in security, curious enough, and PPP actually did a pretty good job advertising. Like, they would just have these, like, you know, they would send out emails. I don't remember exactly how I found out about their first meeting, but I'll tell you, I actually didn't end up joining PPP the first time. So you know, the whole gist of PPP, as with most CTF teams, is you get together, you play a CTF, right? You get together, you know, kind of overnight a CTF. And like, I was in my first or second year of my PhD at this point, kind of slightly bored, you know, kind of like, oh, my research is just going, I guess. I want to find something else to do. And I was like basically looking for something. And I stumbled upon basically PPP. I don't remember how. Genuinely don't remember how I stumbled upon them. But at the time, they had, I think, founded pretty recently, relatively speaking, right? Like this is like 12 years ago at this point. It's a long time. I went to the meeting, and that day they were playing a CTF. It was like a Friday afternoon. I'm not going to name the CTF for reasons that have hopefully become obvious, but I basically, you know, okay, so it's 48-hour CTF. So you sit down and basically, you know, I'm like, okay, this is cool. I'm going to like hack in a room with a bunch of these folks. I don't know any of them. There was Tyler. There was, I think, like Ryan, some other folks. Brian was there too. You know, there's a bunch of like kind of really like OG like folks. At the time, I was just like, oh, there's a bunch of like, you know, kids that I'm going to like play together with, right? I mean, like, I think at the time they were all in undergrad. I was actually like one of the oldest folks, right? Yeah, a PhD student.
That's why it's funny.
But I worked on, and this is no joke, I worked on a Stego problem for 40 hours because I didn't know any better. I was like, you know, they're like, they'd already like solved most of the challenge and they're like, this Stego problem's open. I guess we'll give it to the newbie. It was horrible. It was like, I like file formats. Like, don't get me wrong. Like, I actually really like files and file formats. Like, I know my way around this kind of stuff. And so they gave you a PNG file. I was like, okay, great. PNG files, it's lossless. You can store stuff in the least significant bits or whatever. Like, I knew this stuff, right? I'm like, okay, I'm going to look at the LSBs. Okay, it's just random. That's probably not, okay. Well, what else? I mean, is it like in the red, green, blue channels? Like, any of those things? No. Like, can we just do entropy stuff? Can we, like, look at Steghide? Like, no. I basically just, like, just bashed my head against the wall, like, looking at hex dumps of this stuff for, like, hours. It's, like, 2 a.m. I remember distinctly, like, going off to the subway because it's the only thing open, grabbing a sandwich and, like, you know, going back to the building and being like, I'm kind of sad. Like, this is really, like, depressing. I don't, like, and it was, like, I hacked until the morning on this. Like, my very first CTF, I hacked all the way until the morning. I didn't get anywhere. And I was like, this, I wanted to be interested, but this kind of sucked, like really hard. And when I found out, you know what the solution to that problem was? They had put a gzip encoded payload in column-wise in the LSBs of this image. Column-wise. So you're not even like the normal left-to-right ordering in the file. Column-wise, and it's gzip encoded, so the only thing you've got to hold on to is like the first couple bits of the gzip header, and then it's compressed.
Absolute memers. Yeah, it's the classic.
This is how CTFs used to be. This is what people don't realize. Like
classic CTF.
The thing is, like post hoc, everybody else was like, "Yeah, that was the worst CTF we've ever played." It was my first, and it was my last for 2 years, because I was like, that sucks so bad. I'm never doing this. So actually, like, I literally just did not play CTF with them for another 2 years. It was a couple years later, a friend of mine dragged me over to DEF CON. Like, a friend of mine from Saskatoon. So I, you know, grew up in Saskatoon. Old friend was like, yeah, you know, want to go to DEF CON? It's like the security conference. I'm like, yeah, I'm interested. So I went to DEF CON. I did some of the badge challenge stuff at DEF CON, and I popped by the CTF floor and PvP was there playing. I'm like, yeah, that's my school. I'm like, that's interesting. anyway, and I didn't really give it much else of a thought, right? That they were kind of like there. I think it probably subconsciously primed me to like be interested in this again, maybe. I'm not really sure. Because I was. And so I was like out of the CTF. I was like, no, I'm going to do CTFs. That's boring. I'm going to go do my HCI research because that's much more fun. And I get to travel places to do that.
Right.
I was walking around one of the buildings and there was a poster with just SSH something, something, something written on it. That was it. That was the entire poster, right? It's a nice, you know, green text thing, right? Whatever. I was like, I got to try that, right? Like, you know. You just have to try it. It was like, you know, so I SSH'd into the thing and it was like a little like buffer overflow like game. I was like, okay, I'm going to like figure out how this works and like download the binary, like figure out like, you know, there were three little levels. At the end of it, like I spent basically like a week on this because it was a distraction from research. This is a very good distraction from research, right?
Oh, Jan knows all about CTFs and that. So,
And at the end of it, they were like, you know, congratulations, email this and we'll give you a mug. Also come to our meetings. And so I showed up and was like, oh, it's the same crew again.
Nice.
Like, well, that was interesting. And they're like, yeah, they usually look like that. I was like, you know, okay. 2 years later, I rejoined PvP, because I don't think I would have really kind of be considered a member the first time around, right? And started to play in CTFs and stayed out of the stable category and had a lot of fun with basically everything else. So Pwn, Rev were places that I just got really, really interested in. And that was sort of the beginning of the journey. To hear the other folks in PvP tell it, you know, that one bad CTF just nearly made me just completely nope out of the entire thing. I was lucky that I was still interested somewhere in the back of my head.
Well, clearly you were interested even in security. I mean, you were going to DEF CON. Like, that in itself is a pretty big indication that you're interested.
To be clear, though, I was going to get DEF CON.
Yeah, yeah.
The first time I was there, I was just like, it's DEF CON, right? You're just kind of like completely lost, right? Yeah. But I had my friend, he was interested as well. He's like a sysadmin now. So he does like sysadmin work. And so he kind of security adjacent. Professionally, he's much more into security than I am, I think. Right. But that was like, I was interested enough to, you know, to do those things, certainly.
Wild.
When we started hosting DEF CON CTF, we actually had on our website, like a diatribe against Stego challenges. Basically, it's the easiest for like category to just completely fuck up, and you know they're just it's so easy to make it practically unsolvable that. I don't know if you remember, there was a team that put out a Stego challenge that was actually unsolvable.
Yeah, they just catted Devu random to a...
Yeah, and this was a huge... trying to remember, a European CTF. I don't remember which one. Somewhere around like 2017, 2018 era. And it was like a big chaos on Twitter in the aftermath of like, you fuckers, I spent 48 hours and this was intentionally unsolvable. And I think they like... actually said this challenge is unsolvable in the description, but of course, like, you know,
you can't tell CTF players that.
Yeah.
I'm looking at my history here. That was 2012. The bad one was 2012, and didn't play anything until 2014. So it was literally 2 years. 2 years of just that's the only thing I worked on for the entire CTF. So yeah, Stego challenges must die.
Yeah, it reminds me of the sheep assholes, I think, that we talked about. We've talked about on this show.
I think we've alluded to it. I'm not sure how much we got into, but you brought it up, so you might as well.
There was my first CTF. Is this true? Yeah, my first CTF was DEF CON Quals 2009. Luckily, I didn't work on any Stego challenges, but there were a couple of people working on them. And at one point, I look over at their desktop and they're like zoomed in on you know, looking at the pixels of a sheep's asshole from a photograph of a bunch of sheep. And this was like where the challenge had led them to. And they solved it. No. They solved this challenge. But hours into looking at these pixels of butts, they realize that the flag is in the title of the webpage.
Wait, is that right? Oh, because that's right. We're getting into like old CTF lore where like, you know, I think we could preface all these things with back in my day. Like back in my day, there was no consistent flag. You actually didn't know when you were looking at the flag or not. And there would be cases where people would try to decode something that actually was the flag. Like,
there's something like, "Welcome to Sheep Hell" was the title of the page. And it was like, so eventually someone tried to type "Welcome to Sheep Hell" into the flag submission and it worked.
Bloody Codegate was absolutely infamous for this. Like, I remember several instances of Codegate where it was just a phrase. It was just a phrase with like a period at the end. And you'd cat flag and you'd be like, really? Like, is that... You know, and that's if you cat flag. If you solve any of the crypto challenge, like, good luck. Mm-hmm. It's like, just, you know, you don't know if you're looking at the flag or not, right? And it would have, like, punctuation and stuff in it. So
every variant of that. And, like, sometimes you could guess the rest of the flag if you got, like, half of it.
Oh, the good old days, yeah. Yeah, that was really weird.
Sorry, I was just thinking, like, you know, from a reasonable perspective, you could be like, I see what people get with steganography. Like, steganography itself is kind of a field or whatever, and, like, it's like a puzzle, right? And that's kind of what I think well-intentioned people do, but they never think through it the other way of, like, but how does somebody get there, right? It's like it's like too many paths available that you don't even know which one to even start down, whereas, like, I think of Rev and Pwn, other types of challenges, the intended path, at least the starting path, should be relatively straightforward.
Yeah. I mean, with Rev, at least, everything you need is in the binary. The behavior of the binary is completely, like, you can trace the path of the execution, right? So it's just about understanding that. Stego, it's like, well, the state space of possible things that you could do here is just way too big.
Yes.
And, like, we're not going to tell you anything, so it's just guessing, right? It's just, you know, like, can you figure out what the challenge author was thinking?
Yes.
Like, that's not all that fun.
No, it is not. It is not. But it was very popular.
Especially when it's your first CTM, you don't even know what challenge authors think, right?
Like, yeah, you don't understand the meta, exactly. Like, you don't understand what types of things they're thinking about, what types of other CTF challenges are similar that maybe they're trying to riff on. Yeah, it's just like, it's impossible.
And this is something I think about, too, when doing challenge design is, mm-hmm. you know, like, either you make it so that it's obvious it's not for beginners, right? Or you, if it's anything other than that, you make it transparently clear how to even, like, you know, that how to kind of get started. Because you never want to have a challenge where it's somebody's literal first challenge and they just get owned. Because that's not much fun. Like, I had a lot of challenges where I didn't solve them in the CTF, obviously, right? But at least I got somewhere with them. And I could get at the end of that Stego challenge, I was like, that solution sucks.
Yeah,
I know the solution is, and I think that sucks. You know, I don't learn anything from that. Whereas most of the other challenges, you're like, oh, that's a cool technique. Oh, that's a really cool tool. Or that's like a really like neat way of thinking about the problem. So, yeah. Anyway.
Okay, so then you became during your PhD, you became a part-time CTF player, or I guess full-time CTF player.
Yeah, as full-time as you can imagine, actually, because...
I was just going to say, so that was, you were, like, what, every weekend, or what was, like, your CTF
playing
cadence?
Pretty much, yeah. Like, so I'm looking at this right now, and so the timeline is, like, I played this terrible CTF in March 2012, and the next CTF I played was January 2015, so actually 3 years later was the next time I played something. And then that one, I distinctly remember Ricky... from PvP, what I basically sort of unofficial mentor. He's in fact the guy who made the challenge, the SSH challenge, and he said, "You know, your first job is you're going to solve the entire Pwn category on the CTF. It doesn't matter if it takes you like a week or a month or whatever. You're going to solve the whole Pwn category." And that was actually like a really good way to get into it, right? Because not really a timeline, but it's like, you have to learn everything you need to get through all of this. And it was like not a terrible CTF. It was NullCon 2015. And I have, the record of this because I went in full, cleared the entire Pwn and Rev categories over the course of a fairly long period of time. And that was sort of my like, welcome to CTFing. After that, it was sort of like, okay, I'm just going to do a CTF. I think I did, how many events is this? Oh, God, that's a lot.
It's like when you 40, think about how many papers you've reviewed over your
40 events,
career.
40 wow. events in 2015. I have 408 events in this folder, by the way. But yeah, 40 events in 2015 alone. My advisor was always like, you're just up until like super late at night. I'm a super late sleeper, right? And he's like, well, what are you doing? And the answer before 2015 would have been just playing StarCraft with friends. And afterwards it's like, oh, I was like doing CTFs like all weekend, right? It's like, why aren't you doing research? I'm like, well,
the advisor curse.
yeah he's just like, oh, come on. He's like playing games all like weekend or whatever. But so I definitely got into it, like really 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 into it. It was fun, it was exciting, it's still exciting, right? So I'm still CTFing. But yeah, I definitely spent a lot of my kind of time and energy on that. And I don't regret it at all because I learned a ton of things and I had a lot of fun. PvP was a great atmosphere, a great environment to kind of hack with. really good to be there in person with a bunch of people, right, in the same room, kind of just that energy, I think, is also really part of it. Because the PhD is kind of a solo affair,
mm-hmm.
right? And so having kind of like a social thing to do is also like a big part of it. Is, you know, I think the social aspect of it, honestly, was one of the bigger parts of that made it fun for me. Is learning off of all these people who are actually like really, 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 really experienced, right? Like I didn't know that at the time. Now I do, that they'd already been doing this for like a long time. They were super experienced, super, super, super skilled. And, you know, I learned to respect them pretty quick, the folks in PvP.
Okay, maybe I don't want to cross the streams too much, but did you see even in your PhD that like the skills that you were creating while doing CTFs, did any of that bleed over into your research?
Yeah. It did, actually. My HCI research is technical HCI. I was always going to do technical HCI, like technical meaning that,
can
like...
Can you describe, our audience and for us?
Yeah, so HCI is commonly seen as kind of one of the softest fields of computer science.
I was actually surprised when you said, when you said your background, because you had this math and computer science background, and then now you were like, no, now I'm going to do a PhD in humans, basically.
Yeah, right. Well, so, and actually, you know, like, I was at Waterloo when I'd already sort of mostly figured I was going to do HCI, and I remember being in a room with a bunch of other, like, graduates, and they're like, oh, I'm going to go off to Stanford and do, like, a PhD in, like, pure math. I'm going to do, like, you know, I'm going to go to, like, you know, this company to do, like, quant finance stuff. I'm like, I'm going to do HCI. And they're like, who are you in this room? Aren't you supposed to be, like, a design school or something? Like, what are you doing here, right? I literally got ostracized, I think, at that, you know. And as it turns out, the HCI is a pretty big field. Chi conference is, like, 10,000 or 10 years long. It's, like, a huge conference, right? Like, absolutely massive. And part of this is because it's sort of like this intersection of computer science, and then you have like psychology and like design, and then sociology and a bunch of other like kind of fields mixed in, right? And engineering too, and a bunch of other stuff. So it's this sort of super multidisciplinary thing. And yeah, there's parts of HCI where they're like just like, okay, we're gonna like just see how people use stuff, right? Because we want to know how like people think. And that's a big part of HCI, but so is like building things for people. And that's a lot of engineering. And it's actually really hard engineering because people are really messy. Because if you build like a compiler, you're like, okay, the compiler works or it doesn't. It's sort of like one or the other, right? If you build something for people, it's like, it like mostly works for like people with fingers of this size. But like if they have really small fingers or really big fingers, then it doesn't work. And then you have like engineer around that. So like, you know, because people are messy and there's a big variance and there's a bunch of stuff. Or like if you do like accessibility, it's like everything you do is long tail because like literally there's just a million different things that people may need in order to successfully use a system.
Mm-hmm.
And you're just basically constantly dealing with kind of like, you know, this very, very, very complex landscape of edge cases and sort of long tail needs. And that's very, very complicated, hard work. Engineering that is way harder, I think, in some sense, than even building like an operating system, because you just have to work with all this stuff. So I work much, much more in the kind of the technical HCI side of things. So building systems, like a big part of my PhD was building touch sensing. So making it possible to like detect touches on surfaces. It turns out this is really hard if you don't want to instrument the surface. It turns out this is really hard because people's fingers are all different sizes and shapes and, you know, like infrared reflectivities and stuff like that. And you have to engineer around all this stuff. But I actually found this kind of hacking thing to be really useful. Like several mm-hmm. of my papers were literally, like one of the papers I published that turned out to be one of the most impactful works was based on having literally reverse engineered this like Linux kernel thing to pull out the raw touchscreen data. So this is actually kind of neat. Like, so you have you know, your phone has a capacitive array on it, right? When you touch the screen, this capacitive array basically is like 2D grid, senses the ambient electrical field. And the raw data is there, but it's usually processed by the controller and then sent as a XY position for the touch. As it turns out, on one of these phones that we were playing with, there's an undocumented API that you can go talk to that just gives you the raw data. And we figured out this API. I was kind of just messing with this and was like, oh, this API is kind of neat. Figured out that you could actually overclock the Linux kernel module by disabling the I2C maximum speed limit and just overclocking this bus. So you could get this thing at 30 FPS. So it's actually like, you know, kind of more real time. And then you could just basically do cool stuff like pull out like the angle of the finger over top of the screen. Because you can detect like kind of the very subtle capacitive data down here tells you kind of like, this is like an HCI thing, but it was like, I built a custom kernel module for this, which I think there's a like a single digit number of HCI researchers who have built kernel modules. Let's just put it that way, right? And that was a lot of stuff driven off of this kind of like, oh yeah, by the way, you can do hacking things, and that hacking tends to actually be useful. Well, okay, for HCI, it's useful in general, right? It's kind of like a way of seeing the world almost, but it turns out to like be useful. It's kind of like a weird superpower to have in this field, right? Or maybe any field, I don't know. Yeah. So.
Yeah, I mean, you're very clearly, call it security or whatever you want, but like that hacker mentality, I think it's very clear you even had from a young age, right? Of like, just the like, how does it work? How can I figure out how it works? How can I like do what I want, right? Like your goal is I want super, you know, high frequency touch data from this device. How can I get that? And then like you do whatever you need to do in order to make that happen.
Yep. Yeah. And honestly, it's kind of neat because like once you have the hacker mentality, you're like, there are things that like you know, I think kind of most developers would say, oh, I just run into a brick wall. I can't go past this point. You're like, what do you mean? Like just hack past it, right? Like, you know, write some like janky, like crappy like kernel driver to get past this or whatever, right? Just like just hack past it. What's wrong? You know?
Yeah. So I've noticed some colleagues need to remember that when they're talking to PhD students sometimes who haven't developed that yet, because they can be very be like, oh, just do this and this. And you're just like, I think you just described to them like 6 months worth of work in that one sentence where I know it'd take you like 2 days, but
yeah.
But developing that mindset that you can do it, right? And whether you choose to or not, depending on the project or whatever, is different, right?
It's also, you know, it is a different mindset from HCI research necessarily. It's also a different mindset from security research, believe it or not.
Yeah, yeah.
Like what you just said is a lot of our students, they don't necessarily have that mindset if they're not CTFers, right? There's a very, you know, big difference in a researcher that in the weekends has a normal, healthy life versus a researcher that spent their weekend CTFing in this regard, in the like, you know what, I'm just going to solve it, whatever. And, you know, some of those solutions end up insane and not really, you know, necessarily reusable for future research, but they definitely have solutions.
Which I am definitely guilty of myself, I believe. I think the worst I ever felt was handing off one of the projects I did for my PhD to one of my PhD students. I was like, I'm so sorry. You're going to have to like figure out how to run this. It's terrible, but it worked at one point.
You know, that hack, right? The touchscreen hack, like that's obviously unworkable because as far as rewriting the kernel module. But I took that to a startup company and we sold the tech to a major smartphone manufacturer and they re-engineered the whole phone just to make that feature work based on the capacitive touch data. And they sold 100 million phones with this feature that we developed that originally started by just like hacking the capacitive screen. Because, you know, the company will re-engineer their whole stack to do it, right? But you have to demonstrate it's possible. And that's kind of I think that the value of hacking is not so much the hack itself, but the realization that that's actually possible unlocks things that are otherwise not going to happen.
And you just described research, right? I mean, this is where I see as the point of research, right? You're doing something that people didn't know is possible or didn't know that you could do that. And then the companies then can go actually make it work in the real world. Because like you said, it requires, you know, significant changes probably to everything to make that happen. But if you show them the benefit and the cool things that can come out of that, then that's really important.
Yep.
Crazy.
Yeah, so I've gotten to, you know, experience that, I think, was also kind of fun. So yeah, I apply a hacker mentality to my work. So it's not that the, you know, HCI and security have never crossed in my mind. They do a lot.
That's very cool. Then maybe you can walk us through briefly the creation of Maple Bacon. So you go out there on the job market, you get this great job. Wait, okay, go ahead.
Even before that,
sure.
On the job market, because you know, we tell a lot of our students, again, Shellfish is mostly predominantly a PhD student team, which is, I think, slightly different than PPP or a lot of other student teams. And of course, PhD students span the spectrum of, you know, they will ignore their studies to the max until we have to intervene, ignore their research to play CTF, all the way to they're really interested in CTF, but every weekend they do CTF. They're like, I should really be doing my research. And then they come to us and they're like, you know, I really want a CTF, but I feel like I should be doing more. And then we have to almost like encourage some of them to like, no, go do CTF, you know, be free, then do your research afterwards. But there's a lot of, as a PhD student that spent most of my time CTFing, I thought about the impact on you know, the viability of getting an academic job afterwards, right? And I actually found it to be positive for me personally, just because how my journey went. Well, what did you find? Like, was there any bearing on getting your academic job?
So I'll say this, actually. I need to be busy, I think, is the thing. So my philosophy, I'm like pretty hardcore ADHD, to be honest. And like one of the things is it's hard for me to do like just to have just like one thing in my mind, the one research project, for example, and just like, you know, like kind of just. So actually, first of all, I didn't have just one research project going. I usually had like three or four kind of going in parallel for most of my PhD, which was helpful. But some of it's not hyper technical work. Like you can get into the user study part, you're like, I'm just going to get a bunch of people to like drag a bunch of people in and like let them touch the thing for like an hour. That's not really very, you know, like intellectually engaging work, right? And so having the CTFs in some sense was a counterbalance to this. It was an opportunity to go like really hardcore, like I'm just going to do like super hardcore technical stuff. I'm going to ignore my research for 48 hours. So I was definitely the, oh, there's a CTF? Okay, drop everything. Let's go to CTF, right? That was me through pretty much most of my PhD, which probably frustrated my advisor, but I still got the papers done because I would apply the exact same logic to the papers, right? Oh, there's a deadline in like, you know, like 3 days? Fine. I'm going to drop everything and right. I'm going to basically write. And as long as I was able to do that, it was fine. I actually got both of those things done. It was more exciting for me because the adrenaline rush, I think, is actually just helpful for me. I'm probably just an adrenaline junkie in disguise, right?
This is the crazy thing that I talk to people and I'm like, I am, my extreme sports is deadlines.
Yeah.
You know, how close can you push it?
You've certainly structured your life to take advantage of that.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's me too. Right. And I think, to a large part, actually, the CTF is very helpful for this because you have the 48 hours. It's time boxed. It's mm-hmm. gonna, you know, do or die. Deadlines are the same way. It's do or die. And actually, weirdly enough, I benefit from that. This is obviously just a personal psychology thing because I definitely don't recommend this for everybody. But I really like enjoyed being able to do that because it also meant that CTFs would never bleed into my regular research because it's over on Sunday and then I sleep and then I go back to work and I do my like, you know, research stuff for the rest of the week. And I'm energized because I had this weekend to kind of do all the kind of the hardcore technical stuff. And I can go do maybe technical stuff, maybe not technical stuff, right? Because, you know, doing research is not all solving little challenges. A lot of it's just like debugging some random bit of code, right? Like testing stuff out with people, right? Reading lots and lots of papers, that sort of thing, right? So, you know, I think it was a really good way to kind of balance out my interests and actually feed my interests in a way that made me feel kind of like complete. At the end of it, I think it was very positive actually for my job prospects. And the biggest reason is because that became kind of like, I'm going to come to your school and I'm going to do a bunch of cool research in HCI, because I've got a good track record of doing that. And also, by the way, I'll do the security thing too.
I see.
Did not have a security course when I joined the school. When I joined in 2018, there was 2019, there was no security class. And actually, one of the first things I actually set out to do was develop a security class, which is pretty... Like, first of all, everybody tells you this is people will tell you this is a terrible idea because you're like pre-tenure. You're supposed to just be doing research. I'm like, I see there's a gap in the curriculum. There's a security class that I want to teach. There's a security class that's in my head, pretty much, right? Like, it's essentially a CTF class. I want to teach this class. I want to make this happen. And I basically just, like, overrode my department head's objection and said, I'm just going to make this class happen, right? And ultimately, yeah, that last year was the first instance of this new computer security class that I taught. It went very well. We taught it again this year, earlier this year. And, like, it's been fantastic. And it's like, the only weird thing is just like, why is the HCI guy teaching the security class? That's the only weird thing. But
you
like,
just walk in with your black badges and nothing, you know, don't say anything and let them figure it out.
Yeah.
Do you think that if you had taken your security course, your journey would have been different?
I like to think so, actually. I've excited several people in the class. So we had a student who, like, the first year I taught it, end of the class, the student was like, oh, I'm an econ student. I'm like, not even in CS. By the way, here's a security bug I found in this thing. Can I write a blog post? I'm like, oh boy, what have I done? Yeah, so he takes apart APKs for a living now. I think that's, yeah, I would say I would hope at least that I'm inspiring some folks. I know several folks who took the security class and went off to do security careers.
Sure.
I mean, given that's the one class that's doing security, it's pretty easy to attribute sort of the interest, right? And so I actually...
You specifically.
If I had taken my class... If I had taken my class, I think things might have gone differently. Yeah. But also we have a CTF team now, right? Which we didn't in
True.
Waterloo, really.
Yep.
So that's also a big difference.
That's a good point.
But yeah, I mean, and the CTF team, making the CTF team is also a big part of this. Like I said, you know, that when making the CTF team, there was a lot of tremendous interest when I started, you know, in the team. COVID was a bit of a weird time because of the meeting stuff, but otherwise, you know, we grew quite well. We were still able to play online. It was nice to have actually established teams sort of pre-COVID so that there's kind of students who are interested. And as you can see, you know, we've had quite a lot of successful alumni come out of the program. So I'm very, I think, like, at this point in my career, right, like, me just, like, going and actually doing CTFs is not the impact that I'm looking for anymore always, right? It's I'm looking for broader impact. I'm looking to inspire people. I'm looking to get people into security and into HCI too. So there's that. right? And to get people kind of, like, you know, into this field in a way that is actually exciting and engaging. And I think CTFs are really the way to do that. So this is what I've really oriented a lot of my my impact around in the school. Yeah, so has it been helpful for the job? Absolutely, right? Has it been helpful for, like, say, tenure promotion? I think absolutely as well, right? Because it's an impact that I can kind of point to and say, and by the way, also I'm doing a bunch of this stuff. You know, not only do I have a research record, but I've got kind of all this other stuff that's going on that's, you know, that's different from what other folks are doing.
And not just different from what other people are doing. I mean, it's definitely more impressive that this is not your main research area. Like, when they see, we run these CTF teams, it's like, well, of course you do. Like, I don't know. Like, of course we don't have to do it. So I'm sure hopefully it looks good. But yeah, that does make it definitely more, like, intriguing, maybe is the right word.
Yeah. Well, I think I've never been one to do kind of just one thing, right? The, like, combinatorics optimization computer science thing was the same way in, like, Waterloo. It was like the combinatorics is sort of pure mathy, and then the computer science is very not pure mathy. And I just wanted to do both of those things. Like, and the computer science, I wanted to do like real time operating systems. Like, I was like, I'm gonna go sit down and write an OS, and then I'm gonna go and figure out some graph theory thing over here. I was always kind of like, I kind of want to just do both of these things. I don't know, it's just my left right brain thing going on. I don't know, but yeah,
I mean, you're maybe you're seeking out challenges or new things, right? And, like, I don't know,
or just keeping one foot in each door.
There you go. Yeah. Do you have any interest in the, now that you have tenure, you can kind of do whatever you want, right? So do you have any interest in shifting fields? I'm just curious if you're, like, thinking about this as shifted at all.
Yeah, I've always wanted to, actually. And we've recently hired a bunch of really excellent security folks in our department as well, that I'm eager to actually get to, you know, to collaborate with. So I think there's a very real chance of that. Frankly, I don't really know much about academic security research. So that would be sort of the step one, is just sort of, like, figure out what what that entails, honestly. You know, have students sort of like interested in working on that. That student probably wouldn't be the biggest concern, but it's really more just like, I don't know how to write a music paper, really.
Yeah.
Right.
I recently broke into the education area because of Pwn College, like in terms of publishing and academic education venues. And it's just without a co-author that like knows how to write the USENIX paper or whatever, right? Like you just have to march into the meat grinder for a year.
Yeah.
Those redact that you're like, oh, this is how it works.
Exactly. And that's like what we did when we first got into like qualitative research, like doing, you know, like interviews and those kinds of things, like in security, but completely different than like what I did during my PhD or even I think what anyone in the lab was doing. And yeah, we got like rejected 3 or 4 times before finally like we got it and then the students start getting it. And then now it becomes a lot easier. And now the cool thing, what I love about it is you're already starting to see that mindset morph into some of the other students. So they go, oh yeah, we built this thing. I'm like, okay, great, but like who's going to use this? Well, humans are going to use it and it's going to make this job easier. Like, great, why don't we go talk to them and like actually watch them use it so that
hey,
we can
you're doing
like,
HCI research.
Honestly,
hey!
Yeah, like some of it, you know, in some sense that is because that's where a lot of I think maybe even that ties into when you were learning about security. This was like very dry. Like I thought you were going to talk about access control and Bella Padula and all this kind of like, you know, theoretical stuff that every time I teach that stuff, people are like, yeah, but what about this? And what about this? And what about this? Like in the real world, they think about actually using this stuff with real humans. And it's like very clear that these models don't work on humans. And so was a big focus, I think, a lot of times, like, oh, we're just doing technical stuff. Like, we're just building cool stuff. We're finding things. But it's like, no, like, we're actually doing stuff for humans oftentimes, especially as we want to get into, you know, reverse engineering research. It's like, well, the whole point of that is a human at the end. So you do need to, like, if you
do
just
HCI.
Tell me. Exactly. Yeah. I mean,
do HCI, right?
I don't want to say I'm doing HCI, Robert. That makes me feel very uncomfortable because that's like honing in on another research area. But we definitely are taking elements of that into our research.
We're thinking about humans.
There's probably a room for reverse engineered tools at CHI. I'm just going to say, you know, at our big HCI conference.
That is interesting. I hadn't thought about that.
Yeah, we almost
you shouldn't talk about submitted. Work that's under okay. You can talk.
Yeah, yeah.
You can say you were targeting.
We
it.
Almost submitted to CHI a couple of weeks ago, but
okay.
Just didn't quite make it. So it's gonna be a USENIX paper.
Yeah, it's hard to we found out it's really hard to grind out those user studies.
User studies, yeah.
Close to a deadline.
A week to submission.
Yeah. You can write the paper a week to the deadline, but not all the user studies. So yeah.
a little tougher, but it's interesting. So Adam, you wanted to talk about the creation of Maple Bacon?
I think we kind of actually hit on it with this last. I think we got in there. Yeah. So
go ahead. What I want to ask now, we've kind of covered your journey up to now, but like, let's talk about the individual. I don't know, the I'm trying to think of the analogy. I guess the flags, you know, you catch along the way. What, like, your top categories, Pwn and Rev.
I think I like to think of myself as sort of like a more of a jack of all trades these days. I started in Pwn and Rev is what is the categories that I started in and I still find kind of probably the most comfortable. But I've done a fair bit of crypto. You know, I've written my own like lattice solving library for modular equations, linear equations, modulo, arbitrary moduli, that sort of thing. I've done a bunch of the crypto kind of challenges in general. That's very tied to math, so that's helpful. I tend to actually spend an inordinate amount of time actually working on MISC challenges in a lot of CTFs. I still stay fairly far away from anything that's tagged Stego, but anything else, pretty much, like MISC is sort of a category that I spent that has a special fondness in my heart. Like there's a CPU reversing one, which I guess is mostly Rev, but it's very like kind of different Rev that I did. But just generally, I think of myself as sort of like, I kind of just want to do all of these things. except for web. Web feels very guessy to me. So I if you were to like draw the little radar plot, I'd be like, web is like all the way down in the middle, right? Like, you know, nothing. And everything else I'd kind of like spend a fair bit of time kind of working on.
Forensics, is it too close to Stego for your taste?
Forensics I'll do. Actually, so a lot of the forensic stuff, for example, when it intersects with things like file formats analysis, like if you're hiding stuff in like metadata and things like that, or if you're hiding stuff in like missing blocks in a file system, like I'll do that because I actually have written tools to take apart file systems and take apart like arbitrary file formats and things like that. So yeah, I'll totally do that. Like machine learning stuff, like AI things, if it's not like just convince an LLM to do X, but it's like, say, mm-hmm. you know, like reverse a machine learning thing to do adversarial stuff, or, you know, analyze like a kind of a complicated machine learning model and like figure out if it's like it's recognizing a flag or something. I'll do that. Yeah.
Like maybe like a Zarda style.
Yeah. Wow. Sure. I don't know what that exactly entails, but it sounds interesting. So, you know, like I'm sort of the kind of person who will just I'm willing to try pretty much anything at a CTF these days. And that's sort of what I like. That's actually like the fun of it is because that's the way I learn the most, is especially interacting with a category that I haven't done a ton of. Right. So I think that's sort of that's my personal philosophy. I know that a lot of people do gravitate towards specific areas. And like, if you were to give me a choice between like solve this like PwnRev challenge versus solve this like MISC challenge, I'd probably still try the PwnRev one first, unless the MISC sounds really interesting. So
what's your favorite challenge you've done?
I was going to ask that too.
My God. So I got into this SSTIC challenge a couple years back. So SSTIC is this French organization that has a name I don't actually remember, but you know, SSTIC is the name of the org. And they do this annual challenge that is this linear kind of, mostly linear, like there's like a 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 kind of stage thing that you go through. And it always involves like forensics, crypto, Pwn, Rev, and some mix of those things. I've just consistently enjoyed that series of challenges. It's super fun. It's individual, which is extra kind of exciting because you kind of like, you just have to do it. You can go through and you have to solve these things. There's been years where like the final thing is like Windows Pwn. It's like Windows kernel Pwn is like the final level. I was like that, one of those challenges have been some of the most fun challenges because it's just like, okay, you've in order to pass this level, you have to do it. And you're going to learn an absolute ton of stuff in the meantime. And actually, I think that's generally just the thing. Learning a bunch of stuff is really just kind of where the interest is for me. For the most part, I don't have a single favorite challenge. The challenges that I like the most are the ones that I've written up and put on my own blog. Mm-hmm. So like the CPU adventure one was super fun, right? Like the one, so this is a challenge where they gave you a binary. And then they told you it was for a machine, a CPU. And then they gave you an NC to connect to it and talk to it. And that was it. They didn't give you an emulator, documentation for the CPU. They didn't give you any of that. It was a file that was the program. And then a Netcat socket to the program running on some server that you couldn't touch. And that was, you had to reverse this whole thing from scratch without knowing anything about the CPU in question.
Wow.
Like you didn't know like opcodes, like you didn't know kind of how that anything was structured. It turns out they were using like 5-bit numbers, and like so everything was sort of like, and they used like Baudot code, like the you know this kind of obscure encoding, and like you have to figure out all of this just from first principles. Like you have a file and you have to open it. You have to figure out like I literally one of the things I did was to resize my hex editor. Window.
I learned this trick from you from one of your blog posts. I was like, what the? I was like, this is so cool. I cannot believe. Yeah, that was very cool.
Right. Like, it was kind of like, that was fun because you basically just started from absolutely nothing and you could get like a full, like, functional disassembly and like understand exactly the program flow, everything by the end of it. I was like, and it's like, you know, so just that journey is kind of fun. And then just being able to be like, I did that. I got to the end of that and I actually made this work. And we figured out the whole system. That was very, very fun. And so things like that, right? But yeah, I generally speaking, if just, you know, I have another completely different challenge that's like reversing like an FPGA. Like they basically like give you an FPGA mm-hmm. like kind of spec. And they're like, okay, here it is. Like figure out how to talk to this thing. Like, okay, great. And then you have to like run the whole thing to this, you know, simulator. And you have to like figure out like all the logical blocks and like you figure out how everything's like put together. And like there's, you know, same kind of idea. It's still reversing. Maybe my good challenges of reversing, but it's like very different kind of fields of reversing, right? So.
So then let's flip it around. What's your favorite challenge that you've written?
Well, the favorite challenge that I wrote, I wrote the challenges that I've written that are, I think are interesting are the ones where a small thing becomes really important. I kind of like this about security. It's like you screw up one thing, you're dead, right? Like, and so I wrote PlaidDB for a Plaid CTF like way, way long ago. And PlaidDB is this challenge where it's like a kind of a, you know, like a key value store, right? So you can, you know, add things to the database, you can remove things from the database, you can edit them or whatever. And there's one bug in the binary, and it's hardened to heck. Like it's ASLR, like NX, binaries, and PIE. Like everything I could throw at the binary is turned on. There's one bug, which is that the input handler can write a null byte past the end of an array. And only a null byte. You don't get anything else. You only get a null byte past the end of an array. And it does this when it like tries to realloc the array. It off mm-hmm. by ones in the realloc. And that's the only bug in the whole binary. And it turns out that, of course, you can use this one bug to, of course, do a bunch of like heap feng shui stuff and whatnot. But it's a very challenging and complex exploit chain because, you know, you have to use a certain size of bucket to make the next thing has to be a certain size in order to make the size change to a different size size class. You have to like arrange all your chunks in a really, really specific order in order to make this all work. You have to, you know, create fake chunks all over the place to take advantage of this bug multiple times, you know, yada, 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 right? But it's such a complicated bug that there's such a complicated exploit, but it's such a simple bug. And I think I really like that about the challenge. What I didn't like was having to solve it myself. So I was going to put it out there. And one of my teammates was like, no, you should probably test it. I'm like, it's probably solvable. Like, that's not how this works. That's not how Plaid CTF challenges work. And I spent, I think, the first like 10 hours of the CTF just solving my own challenge. And I was like, yes, it's actually solvable. Like actually solvable. Now you can release it, right? Like, but what was also really cool at the end of it was watching all the cool tools that people had built to solve that one challenge. So somebody had built this like tool called Villock, which was this malloc drop-in that would watch all the mallocs and then produce this like HTML visualization of like where all the chunks were and like what those chunks were doing at every stage in the process.
They built like, that for PlaidDB.
For PlaidDB. You can search up the... Yeah,
wow, so they built a tool. I've used Villock a lot back in the day.
There's a specific tool for this purpose. And I'm like, wow. Like, I'm very inspired by this because I made that... I kind of sort of inspired that to happen, right? I mean, obviously, the teams are the ones who put in the hard work to actually do that. But to put out a challenge that gets people to write useful tools is kind of like an extra, like, nice thing, right? Because it kind of points out that like there's right now it's like really, but at the time it was very hard to understand the state of the heap. And when I was doing the exploit, I was like, this is miserable. Like I'm just drawing ASCII diagrams to like, you know, like, oh, this is like 80 bytes. This is a hex 80 bytes. This is like hex 90 bytes. Like if you put these things, you know, and they'd, you know, through this 48-hour process, they'd be like, okay, we have to actually write a tool to do this. And I was like, this is cool. Right. That's kind of the sort of thing that I really, really enjoy is getting people to kind of, build interesting things, solve an interesting problem and, kind of able to think about it and then actually ultimately solve it and having other people enjoy, you know, the thrill of doing something that seems impossible is kind of the goal of a good challenge, I think. A good hard challenge, obviously, right? You know,
Cool. I love that. So, I mean, that's, you know, I think that's, like you said, I mean, this kind of gets into the thing I was thinking about your challenge is like, it sounds like kind of a classic weird machine type of challenge where you're like, you take this one tiny little behavior that you can do, like a very small looking bug, and then make it do a bunch of stuff that it's not supposed to do. And then bam, all of a sudden you're taking over everything.
Yeah. So there's lots of stuff like that. I mean, it's been very exciting, you know, being on both sides of this, I guess, you know, sort of, what is it? I've played CTFs. I've helped organize CTFs. I can't say I've actually really kind of done a big organization thing, but, you know, written problems, organized teams, you know.
Do you have any interest in organizing a large CTF? There'll be a call for organizers coming out soon-ish.
We'll see.
Think about it.
Yeah.
I won't put too much public pressure right now, but you know.
Exactly. That'll
come later.
Exactly. Talk to us about Advent of Code.
Oh yeah.
Oh yes, great. Okay.
I did some competitive programming. So Waterloo is like one of the top competitive programming schools in the world, right? And so when I was there, I tried to join the ACM team. So the deal is that they take the top 9 people from their internal like competition and they turn them into 3 teams. And I was 10th.
No. So
I was just sort of like the backbench guy. And I got lucky. I actually ended up like, you know, somebody dropped out and I actually went to regionals and did like miserably because I'm actually not very good at competitive programming, as it turns out. But I've always had like a little bit of interest in competitive programming. And then somebody was like, oh, hey, like this is an Advent of Code thing, which is really popular. And, you know, like, let's all go try this. I'm like, oh, this is fun. I would have to say I'm really surprised that I'm fast at that because I didn't think I was actually a fast typer really like at all. So it was actually surprising to me that I was actually able to crank out a solution fast enough to get on the leaderboard. You know, because the easy ones, you're just basically like, it's just typing. You just like type and type, 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 and you like submit it. Because when I was doing the ACM stuff, I never considered myself to be very fast at the actual art of like entering keys on a keyboard. Because I actually, like, this is mostly how I type.
You're an HCI guy. What? That can't be possible.
I type really.
That's his human computer interface.
Yeah,
now.
Like,
these
I
guys.
Type, like, yeah. Pretty much.
Lefty
yeah.
and righty.
But, well, like, it's evolved into something that sort of involves all my fingers, but it's definitely not, like, the normal typing. It's
oh, my God.
Very...
This is exactly what I did in undergrad. And then when I went to Microsoft, I was like, I need to, like, actually learn how to type. So I did. Yeah. I practiced typing, like, 20 minutes a day. And now
Muds.
I can actually type.
Muds taught me to type.
Yeah.
Because I had to type and look at the screen at the same time.
Yeah. So I never...
faster you type. Yeah.
All right. We won't. This is, I think, one of the nice things about these things is you get to talk to people and you can see that, like, people are different and they,
yeah.
you know.
Yeah, well, but the thing is that it was, I mean, it's a nice thing to do in December when there's not like a whole lot of other stuff going on. Like my classes are mostly kind of ending, right? It's like at the end of the day, it's like kind of, I think it was midnight for me close to, or like, what, like 9, 10 p.m. So it's not like a terrible time. I can sort of sign on and just do something interesting. Although I drove most of my family nuts because I'd be like at like Christmas dinner and be like, bye, I'm going to go run do the contest thing. And they're like, that guy's just crazy. But it was really fun. Because a lot of Advent of Code, the early ones are just basically like, how fast can you just like enter the code that does the thing? Or like figure out like what the thing is asking you to do, because often it's sort mm-hmm. of obfuscated. So you do like kind of super fast read and you're like, okay, I think I know what I have to do. And you basically like punch in the code and make it work. It's very adrenaline rushy, which is pretty much exactly what most CTFs are. But it's an adrenaline rush for like all of like 3 minutes. And you're like, it's done. I'm done. Right. But then the later ones, they turn into like really hardcore puzzles that you have to like sit there and actually solve. And I feel like that's actually where I generally would do better because like I have, you know, all these kind of tricks and kind of ways to think about problems where I get to kind of apply these. And it was weird to find out that, like, basically all, like, a bunch of the PvP people were really good at Advent of Code. Part of this is because I know some of the folks are literally competitive programmers, but also, like, what was surprising is, like, Max, for example, just pulling out Z3 and just, like, destroying one of the Advent of Code challenges. Like, practically, like, didn't have to read it. It was like, okay, this is a Z3 problem. Like, Z3 the whole thing, solve it. Like, you know, like, I'm half an hour faster than everyone else because I have this magical tool, right?
Hey, you know how to use it.
But yeah, I was like, you know, stuff like that. Like, CTFers turned out to, like, have this kind of hacker mentality that works really well for Advent of Code for some reason, even though those are actually sort of different, right? The competitive programming versus the kind of the, like, hacking stuff. I don't actually believe that you have to be a fast typist or even really a fast thinker to do CTF. I think a lot of it, unless you're doing live CTF, I guess. Right? Because a lot of it actually just boils down to really being able to kind of methodically think about things in a, you know, very complicated, like multi-space space. Like if you're poning, for example, like, oh, there's a million things I could do. Like, what's the path that kind of gets me there? Like how to connect all these little things that I've found out together into a coherent like exploit chain, right? So, but it turns out that, I don't know, I was surprised. I surprised myself when I first started doing Avenue Code that I could actually be competitive. And that's what sort of like drove me to continue doing it. Cause I think I'm the sort of person who was like, oh, it's not like clicking, then I'm probably not going to keep doing it. Right.
Yeah. We have a student, I guess an alumni now, whose claim to fame is that he beat you in an Advent of Code challenge time.
I was just going to say, I wonder, do your students come into class and be like, oh God, he beat me again? Like, has anybody like bragged about beating you?
I mean, more recently, it's been easier because I think I've gotten slower over the years. I've been using the same set of libraries, and people are like writing, kind of like upgrading their libraries and like writing languages for this. Like, I'm like, I can't compete with a guy who writes like his own golf language for this. Like, there's no way, right? And also LLMs are a thing, which is sort of sad. But as far as like, I've definitely like talked with people. We have both Maple Bacon and PvP have discussion channels for Avenue Code where we all get to like, you know, kind of rag on each other about like our solutions and stuff. So it's, yeah, there's lots of that. Has a student ever beaten me in Avenue, like any of the students I teach? I don't think that's happened yet, but I also don't think they're all doing Avenue Code. So it's not a fair comparison. Right?
Al for extra credit.
Hey, Pico CTF is literally extra credit in my security class.
That's great.
Right. And actually I would like to, I definitely would love to add Pwn College to that list too, which I likely will do in a future term when I kind of get around to doing it. So.
And get their blue belt, they get 5% extra credit.
5% for that blue belt? That's like
hey man, I'm following your
that's
philosophy.
A lot of, that's not...
It's a lot of challenges or that's a lot of extra credit, Robert?
I think that's a lot of challenges actually. yeah.
Totally 1,000 challenges.
Amazing. Well, all right. Well, I think anything else you'd like to, you know, plug or say, or are you looking for PhD students, or are you looking for, I don't know, operators?
You know, one of these, you know, all of the above, honestly. Like I would like to do security research, but I've got a lot of ideas I think about things, but I'm very new to that area, and I'm going to be completely honest that I'm very, very, very kind of like fresh in security research, academic security research. So this is an area that I absolutely would love to get more involved in. If there's any folks that are willing, I mean, if either of you want to collaborate somewhere, but if there's anything,
think about it.
Yeah. Cause that's definitely something that I'd be interested in. Other than that, I mean, you know, like I have really, really enjoyed CTFing. This is a huge part of who I am at this point. It's going to continue to be because I'm doing, you know, the security class, Maple Bacon, you know, all that stuff. And I really love this community. So like please CTF. It's awesome. It's so much fun. And, you know, thank you guys for hosting.
Great. Yeah, we're happy to do it. So yeah, thanks, Robert, so much for joining us today. Really happy to have you. I'm Adam D. You can find me online at Adam Dupe. He's Zardis. You can find him online at... No. Did I not? It's supposed to be software, whatever.
That's it.
He's Zardis. We're CTF Radio. You can find us on CTF Radio. You can find our questions. In future episode, take care. Happy hacking.